Chapter 20. Letter to Sir W. Pepperell, Letter to Lady Pepperell, Letter to his father, Arrival of M.R. Hawley, Increasing importance of Indian establishment, Schemes of its enemies, Firm stand taken by M.R. Edwards, Letter to M.R. Oliver, Letter to commissioners, Difficulties to the mission, Answer to M.R. Williams, Letter to the people of Northampton, Marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Burr, Letter to M.R. Erskine, Letter to M.R. Hollis, Letter to M.R. Hubbard. The Indian establishment at Stockbridge, being gradually more and more known, excited more and more the attention and interest of the benevolent of England. Among these, Joshua Payne, Esquire of London, addressed a letter to Sir William Pepperell, the governor of the province, requesting the information as to the proper plan of a school for Indian girls at that place. An extract from that letter was forwarded to Mr. Edwards from Sir William, through the Secretary of the Commissioners, with a request that he would write to Sir William on the subject. He accordingly addressed to him the following letter. Stockbridge, November 28, 1151. Honored Sir, when I had the opportunity the last spring of waiting on Your Excellency at your seat at Kittery, and was there gratified and honored by the kind and hospitable entertainment of your house, I was favored with some conversation with you, concerning the affairs of the Indians at Stockbridge, and the business of the mission here, to which I had then been invited. And you were then pleased generously to assure me of your good offices, in affording me any assistance in this employment, which you could render me, through your acquaintance and correspondence in London. I have lately been favored with a letter from the Honorable Andrew Oliver, of Boston, wherein he was pleased to send me an extract of a letter to you from Joshua Payne, Esquire of London, concerning a proper plan of a school for Indian girls in this place, and to propose to me to write to you on the subject of the said extract. This encourages me to hope that a letter from me, on this subject, to Your Excellency will be kindly received. With this hope, I would take leave to say, that I think that, as the boarding schools here are now in their commencement, and are yet to receive their form and character, and that among a people hitherto unaccustomed to any method of instruction whatever, it is a great pity but that the method actually adopted should be free from the gross defects of the ordinary method of teaching among the English. One of these grand defects, as I humbly conceive, is this, that children are habituated to learning without understanding. In the common method of teaching, so far as my observation extends, children, when they are taught to read, are so much accustomed to reading, without any kind of knowledge of the meaning of what they read, that they continue reading without understanding, even a long time after they are capable of understanding, were it not for a habit of making such and such sounds, on the sight of such and such letters, with a perfect inattentiveness to any meaning. In like manner they are taught their catechism, saying over the words by rote, which they begin to say, before they were capable of easily and readily comprehending them. Being long habituated to make sounds without connecting any ideas with them, they so continue, until they come to be capable of well understanding the words, and would perhaps have the ideas, properly signified by the words, naturally excited in their minds on hearing the words, were it not for an habitual hearing and speaking them without any ideas. So that, if the question were put in phraseology somewhat new, to which they have not been accustomed, they would not know what to answer. Thus it happens to children, even with regard to the plainest printed catechisms, even those which have been contrived with great care and art, so that they might be adapted to the lowest capacities. I should therefore think that, in these boarding schools, the children should never read a lesson, without the master or mistress taking care, that the child be made to attend to, and understand, the meaning of the words and sentences which it reads. At least after the child begins to read without spelling, and perhaps in some degree before. And the child should be taught to understand things, as well as words. After it begins to read in a Psalter, Testament, or Bible, not only the words and phrases should be explained, but the things which the lesson treats of should be, in a familiar manner, open to the child's understanding. And the master or mistress should enter into conversation with the child about them. Familiar questions should be put to the child about the subjects of the lesson. And the child should be encouraged, and drawn on, to speak freely, and in his turn also to ask questions, for the resolution of his own doubts. Many advantages would arise from this method. By this means, the child's learning will be rendered pleasant, entertaining, and profitable, as his mind will gradually open and expand with knowledge, and his capacity for reasoning be improved. His lesson will cease to be a dull, wearisome task, without any suitable pleasure or benefit. This will be a rational way of teaching. Assisting the child's reason enables him to see the use, and end, and benefit of reading, at the same time that he takes pains from day to day to read. It is the way also to accustom the child from its infancy to think and reflect, and to beget in it an early taste for knowledge, and a regularly increasing appetite for it. So also, with regard to the method of catechizing children. Beside obliging them to give the answers in the printed catechism, or in any stated form of words, questions should be asked them from time to time, in the same familiar manner, as they are asked questions commonly about their ordinary affairs, with familiar instructions, explanations, and rehearsals of things, intermixed. And if it be possible, the child should be led, by wise and skillful management, into the habit of conversation on divine things, and should gradually be divested of that shyness and backwardness, usually discovered in children, to converse on such topics with their superiors. And when the printed catechisms are used, as I am far from thinking they ought to be entirely neglected, care should be taken that the child should attend to the meaning of the words, and be able to understand them. To this end, not only explaining the words and sentences, but also from time to time varying the phraseology, putting the question in different words of the same sense, and also intermixing with the questions and answers, whether printed or not, some improvement or application, in counsels and warnings given to them, founded on the answers that had been given. Beside the things already mentioned, there are other things, which, as it appears to me, ought to be done, with regard to the education of children in general, wherein the common methods of instruction in New England are grossly defective. The teacher, in familiar discourses, might, in a little time, give the children a short general scheme of the scriptural history, beginning with the creation of the world, and descending through the various periods of that history, informing them of the larger divisions and more important events of the story, and giving them some idea of their connection one with another. First, of the history of the Old Testament, and then of the New. And when the children had in their heads this general scheme, then the teacher might, at certain times, entertain them, in like familiar discourse, with the particular stories of the Scriptures, sometimes with one story, and then with another, before they can obtain the knowledge of them themselves, by reading. For example, at one time the story of the creation, at another time the story of the flood, then the dispersion of the nations, the calling of Abraham, the story of Joseph, the bringing of the children of Israel out of Egypt, and in the New Testament, the birth of Christ, some of the chief acts of his life, his death, his resurrection, his ascension, the effusion of the Holy Spirit at the day of Pentecost, and some of the chief of the acts of the apostles. Withal, pointing out to them the place which each event has in the general scheme, and the connection it has with other main parts of it. The teacher, in a familiar manner, should apply the events of the story discoursed upon, with the design of informing the child's understanding, influencing his heart, and directing his practice. A child, who is able to read his Bible, might be set to read a particular scriptural history, sometimes one, and sometimes another, diligently observing it, and examining for himself all that is said concerning it. And when he has done, he might be called to the master or mistress, and inquired of, concerning the particulars of the history, to see that he has paid attention, and is able to give a good account of it. And I can see no good reason, why children in general, beside the scriptural history, should not, in a like familiar manner of conversation, be taught something of the great successive changes and events, in the Jewish nation, and the world at large, which connect the history of the Old and New Testaments. Thus, they might be informed, in short, of the manner in which the four great monarchies succeeded each other, the persecutions which the Jews suffered from Antiochus Epiphanes, and the principal changes which happened to their church and state, before the coming of Christ. And they might be shown, how such and such events were a fulfillment of such and such prophecies. And when they learn the history of the New Testament, they might, with much profit and entertainment, have pointed out to them many plain prophecies of the Old Testament, which have their fulfillment in him. And I can see no good reason, why children cannot, or may not, be taught something in general of ecclesiastical history, and be informed how things, with regard to the state of religion and the Church of God, have gone on, as to some of the main events, from the time when the scriptural history ended, to the present time, and how given prophecies of the scriptures have been fulfilled in some of these events, or why they may not be told, what may yet be expected to come to pass according to the scriptural prophecies, from this time, to the end of the world. It appears to me obvious, also, that, in connection with all this, they should be taught somewhat relating to the chronology of events, which would make the story so much the more distinct and entertaining. Thus, they may be taught how long it was from the creation of the world to the coming of Christ. How long from the creation to the flood. How long from the flood to the calling of Abraham, etc. How long David lived before Christ. How long before the captivity in Babylon. How long the captivity, before Christ, etc. How long since the birth of Christ. How old he was when he began to preach, and when he was crucified. How long after his resurrection, before he ascended. How long, also, after the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, until Babylon was destroyed by Cyrus. How long after the Persian Empire, before that empire was overthrown by Alexander. When was the great oppression of the Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes. When Judea was conquered by the Romans. How long after Christ's resurrection before the destruction of Jerusalem? And how long before the empire became Christian? How long after Christ before the popes claimed such and such powers? When the worship of images was introduced? How long before the Reformation, etc., etc.? All children are capable of being informed, and having an idea of these things, and can much more easily learn them, if endeavors were used to that end, than many things which they do learn. And with like ease, and with equal benefit, they might be taught some of the main things in geography which way the land of Canaan lies from this. How far it is. Which way Egypt lay from Canaan, which way Babylon lay from Jerusalem, and how far. Which way Padan Aram was from Canaan. Where Rome lay from Jerusalem. Where Antioch, etc., etc. And I cannot but think it might be a pretty easy thing, if proper means were taken, to teach children to spell well, and girls as well as boys. I should think it may be worth the while, on various accounts, to teach them to write, and also to teach them a little arithmetic, some of the first and plainest rules. Or, if it be judged that it is needless to teach all the children all these things, some difference might be made in children of different genius, and children of the best genius might be taught more things than others. And all would serve, the more speedily and effectually, to change the taste of Indians, and to bring them off from their barbarism and brutality, to a relish for those things which belong to civilization and refinement. Another thing, which properly belongs to a Christian education, and which would be unusually popular with them, and which would in several respects have a powerful influence, in promoting the great end in view, of leading them to renounce the coarseness, and filth, and degradation, of savage life, for cleanliness, refinement, and good morals, is teaching them to sing. Music, especially sacred music, has a powerful efficacy to soften the heart into tenderness, to harmonize the affections, and to give the mind a relish for objects of a superior character. In order to promote the salvation of the children, which is the main design of the whole Indian establishment at this place, I think that, beside their attending public worship on the Sabbath, and the daily worship of the family, and catechizing in the school, and frequent counsels and warnings given them, when all together, by their teachers, each child should, from time to time, be dealt with singly, particularly, and closely, about the state and concerns of his soul. And particular care should be taken to teach and direct each child, concerning the duty of secret prayer, and the duty pressed and enforced on every one. And care should be taken, that all may have proper opportunity and convenience for it. I need say nothing concerning buildings, lodgings, household stuff, cattle, servants, husbandry instruments, and utensils for the children's work. As it is agreed on all hands, that these are necessary. And the providing of them will doubtless be left to the care and discretion of the trustees that shall be appointed. But I would beg leave to say further, with regard to methods to forward the proficiency of the children in their learning, that I cannot but think measures might be devised, greatly to encourage and animate them in it, and excite a laudable ambition to excel. One thing I have thought of, which, as appears to me, might have a happy tendency this way: in each of the boarding schools at certain periods, there should be a sort of public examination in the school, on a day appointed for the purpose, which shall be attended by all the trustees, and all in the town who are in any respect connected with Indian affairs, and some of the neighboring ministers, and gentlemen and ladies. And also that the chiefs of the Indians be invited to attend, at which there shall be a public trial of the proficiency which each one has made, in the various branches which have been taught, as in reading, writing, spelling, arithmetic, knowledge in the principles of religion, knowledge of church history, etc., and that a premium shall be given to such as are found to excel, which may be done in something that will very much please Indian children, with but little expense. And likewise, that the works of the children be then produced, to be judged of, that it may be determined who has made the greatest proficiency in learning to sew, to spin, to knit, etc., and that a reward be given to such as have excelled. And perhaps, also, that a reward be then given to such as, by the testimony of their teachers and governors, have excelled in virtue or diligence, in care to speak the truth, in strictly observing the Sabbath, in good manners, in respect to their superiors, etc., and that, in the day of public trial, there be somewhat of an entertainment made for the members of the school, and those who are invited to attend. This not only might tend greatly to stimulate the children in their learning, but would be very pleasing and animating to the tribes of Indians, and would have great influence in rendering them very favorably disposed to the affairs of the schools. But Your Excellency will easily see that, in order to the practicableness of these things, in any tolerable degree and manner, it is necessary that the children should be taught the English tongue. And indeed this is of the most absolute necessity, on almost every account. The Indian languages are extremely barbarous and barren, and very ill-fitted for communicating things moral and divine, or even things speculative and abstract. In short, they are wholly unfit for a people possessed of civilization, knowledge, and refinement. Besides, without their learning English, their learning to read will be in vain. For the Indians have not the Bible, nor any other book, in their own language. Without this, their teachers cannot converse with them, and so can have no advantage to instruct them. Hence, all possible means must be used, in the first place, to introduce the English tongue among the children. To this end, much pains should be taken to teach them the English name for everything, and English words that signify such and such actions. And an interpreter might be used for a while, to interpret their lessons to them, and to teach them to construe them, or turn them into Indian. And a number of English children might be put into the school with the Indian children. But the most effectual method of all would be, to put out some of the Indian children, first, into some good English families, one at a place, to live there a year or two, before they are brought into the school. Which would not only be above all others the most successful method, but would be absolutely necessary, at least at first. But truly a great deal of care must be taken to find good places for them, and to look well to them, and to see that they are well taken care of, in the families to which they are sent. It is probable that the parents of the children might, with proper endeavors, be persuaded to such a measure. But it will doubtless be very easily and quickly determined, by Your Excellency, that, if such methods as those which have been mentioned, or any like them, or indeed any other effectual measures, are taken, it will be absolutely necessary that the school should be under the constant care and inspection of trustees, who live upon the spot, or very near at hand. It will be in vain for any to expect that any woman can look after such a school, and provide for and govern so large a family, and take care continually to order and regulate so many and great affairs pertaining to it, within doors and without, without much assistance of some always at hand, who are able and faithful, and are interested and duly empowered. If she has under her a second, or a kind of usher, and has servants of both sexes, yet still she will be under the necessity of having some superior assistance. And as to the precise method of teaching, and regulating the discipline of the school and family, It must be left very much to their discretion, for experience alone can certainly determine the fittest methods of ordering such an establishment. So new and untried, though very probable conjectures may be made, and experience will doubtless direct to some new measures, which cannot now be thought of. Hoping that Your Excellency will excuse the particularity and minuteness into which I have unintentionally been led on a subject about which I cannot but feel the deepest interest, I remain, with very high respect, your most humble servant, Jonathan Edwards. In the package to Sir William, Mr. Edwards, in consequence of her own request, forwarded to Lady Pepperell, who was then in very deep affliction, the following letter, which will probably be regarded as one of the happiest specimens of Christian sympathy and condolence to be found in epistolary writing. To Lady Pepperell, Stockbridge, November 28, 1751. Madam, when I was at your house in Kittery, the last spring, among other instances of your kind and condescending treatment to me, was this, that, when I had some conversation with Sir William, concerning Stockbridge and the affairs of the Indians, and he generously offered me any assistance, in the business of my mission here, which his acquaintance and correspondence in London enabled him to afford me, and proposed my writing to him on our affairs. You were also pleased to invite me to write to you at the same time. If I should neglect to do as you then proposed, I should fail not only of discharging my duty, but of doing myself a great honor. But as I am well assured, even from the small acquaintance I had with you, that a letter of mere compliments would not be agreeable to a lady of your disposition and feelings, especially under your present melancholy circumstances. So the writing of such a letter is very far from my intention or inclination. When I saw the evidences of your deep sorrow, under the awful frown of heaven in the death of your only son, it made an impression on my mind not easily forgotten. And when you spoke of my writing to you, I soon determined what should be the subject of my letter. It was that which appeared to me to be the most proper subject of contemplation for one in your circumstances. That, which I thought, above all others, would furnish you a proper and sufficient source of consolation under your heavy affliction. And this was the Lord Jesus Christ, particularly the amiableness of his character, which renders him worthy that we should love him, and take him for our only portion, our rest, hope, and joy, and his great and unparalleled love towards us. And I have been of the same mind ever since, being determined, if God favored me with an opportunity to write to your ladyship, that those things should be the subject of my letter. For what other subject is so well calculated to prove a balm to the wounded spirit? Let us then, dear madam, contemplate the loveliness of our blessed Redeemer, which entitles him to our highest love. And, when clearly seen, leads us to find a sweet complacency and satisfaction of soul in him, of whatever else we are deprived. The Scriptures assure us that he, who came into the world in our nature, and freely laid down his life for us, was truly possessed of all the fullness of the Godhead, of his infinite greatness, majesty, and glory, his infinite wisdom, purity, and holiness, his infinite righteousness and goodness. He is called the brightness of God's glory, and the express image of his person. He is the image, the expression, of infinite beauty, in the contemplation of which, God the Father had all his unspeakable happiness from eternity. That eternal and unspeakable happiness of the Deity is represented as a kind of social happiness, in the society of the persons of the Trinity. Proverbs 8:30. Then I was by him, as one brought up with him. I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him. This glorious person came down from heaven to be the light of the world, that by him the beauty of the Deity might shine forth, in the brightest and fullest manner, to the children of men. Infinite wisdom also has contrived that we should behold the glory of the Deity, in the face of Jesus Christ, to the greatest advantage, in such a manner as should be best adapted to the capacity of poor feeble man. In such a manner, too, as is best fitted to engage our attention, and allure our hearts, as well as to inspire us with the most perfect complacency and delight. For Christ having, by his incarnation, come down from his infinite exaltation above us, has become one of our kinsmen and brothers. And his glory shining upon us through his human nature, the manifestation is wonderfully adapted to the strength of the human vision. So that, though it appears in all its effulgence, it is yet attempered to our sight. He is indeed possessed of infinite majesty, to inspire us with reverence and adoration. Yet that majesty need not terrify us, for we behold it blended with humility, meekness, and sweet condescension. We may feel the most profound reverence and self-abasement, and yet our hearts be drawn forth sweetly and powerfully into an intimacy the most free, confidential, and delightful. The dread, so naturally inspired by His greatness, is dispelled by the contemplation of His gentleness and humility. While the familiarity, which might otherwise arise from the view of the loveliness of His character merely, is ever prevented by the consciousness of His infinite majesty and glory. And the sight of all His perfections united fills us with sweet surprise and humble confidence, with reverential love and delightful adoration. This glory of Christ is properly, and in the highest sense, divine. He shines in all the brightness of glory that is inherent in the Deity. Such is the exceeding brightness of the Sun of Righteousness, that, in comparison of it, the light of the natural sun is as darkness. And hence, when He shall appear in His glory, the brightness of the sun shall disappear, as the brightness of the little stars do when the sun rises. So says the prophet Isaiah, "Then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun shall be ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion, and before His ancients gloriously." Isaiah 24:23. But, although His light is thus bright, and His beams go forth with infinite strength, yet, as they proceed from the Lamb of God, and shine through His meek and lowly human nature, they are supremely soft and mild, and, instead of dazzling and overpowering our feeble sight, like a smooth ointment or a gentle salve, are vivifying and healing. Thus on them, who fear God's name, the Sun of Righteousness arises, with healing in His beams. Malachi 4:2. It is like the light of the morning, a morning without clouds, as the dew on the grass, under whose influence the souls of His people are as the tender grass springing out of the earth, by clear shining after rain. Thus are the beams of His beauty and brightness fitted for the support and reviving of the afflicted. He heals the broken in spirit, and bindeth up their wounds. When the spirits of His people are cut down by the scythe, He comes down upon them, in a sweet and heavenly influence, like rain on the mown grass, and like showers that water the earth. Psalm 72:6. But especially are the beams of Christ's glory infinitely softened and sweetened by His love to men, the love that passeth knowledge. The glory of His person consists, preeminently, in that infinite goodness and grace, of which He made so wonderful a manifestation, in His love to us. The Apostle John tells us, that God is light. 1 John 1:5 and again, that God is love. 1 John 4:8 and the light of His glory is an infinitely sweet light, because it is the light of love. But especially does it appear so, in the person of our Redeemer, who was infinitely the most wonderful example of love that was ever witnessed. All the perfections of the Deity have their highest manifestation in the work of redemption, vastly more than in the work of creation. In other works, we see Him indirectly. But here, we see the immediate glory of His face. 2 Corinthians 3:18. In His other works, we behold Him at a distance. But in this, we come near, and behold the infinite treasures of His heart. Ephesians 3:8, 9, 10. It is a work of love to us, and a work of which Christ is the author. His loveliness, and His love, have both their greatest and most affecting manifestation in those sufferings, which He endured for us at His death. Therein, above all, appeared His holiness, His love to God, and His hatred of sin, in that, when He desired to save sinners, rather than that a sensible testimony should not be seen against sin, and the justice of God be vindicated, He chose to become obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Thus, in the same act, He manifests, in the highest conceivable degree, His infinite hatred of sin, and His infinite love to sinners. His holiness appeared like a fire, burning with infinite vehemence against sin. At the same time, that His love to sinners appeared like a sweet flame, burning with an infinite fervency of benevolence, it is the glory and beauty of His love to us, polluted sinners, that it is an infinitely pure love. And it is the peculiar sweetness and endearment of His holiness, that it has its most glorious manifestation in such an act of love to us. All the excellencies of Christ, both divine and human, have their highest manifestation in this wonderful act of His love to men, His offering up Himself a sacrifice for us, under these extreme sufferings. Herein have abounded toward us the riches of His grace, in all wisdom and prudence. Ephesians 1:8. Herein appears His perfect justice. Herein, too, was the great display of His humility, in being willing to descend so low for us. In His last sufferings, appeared His obedience to God, His submission to His disposing will, His patience, and His meekness, when He went as a lamb to the slaughter, and opened not His mouth, but in a prayer that God would forgive His crucifiers. And how affecting this manifestation of His excellency and amiableness to our minds, when it chiefly shines forth in such an act of love to us. The love of Christ to men, in another way, sweetens and endears all His excellencies and virtues. As it has brought Him into so near a relation to us, as our friend, our elder brother, and our Redeemer, and has brought us into an union so strict with Him, that we are His friends, yea, members of His body, of His flesh, and of His bones. Ephesians 5:30. We see then, dear madam, how rich and how adequate is the provision which God has made for our consolation in all our afflictions, in giving us a Redeemer of such glory and such love. Especially, when it is considered, what were the ends of this great manifestation of beauty and love in His death? He suffered, that we might be delivered. His soul was exceeding sorrowful, even unto death, to take away the sting of sorrow, and to impart everlasting consolation. He was oppressed and afflicted, that we might be supported. He was overwhelmed in the darkness of death, that we might have the light of life. He was cast into the furnace of God's wrath, that we might drink of the rivers of His pleasures. His soul was overwhelmed with a flood of sorrow, that our hearts might be overwhelmed with a flood of eternal joy. We may also well remember, in what circumstances our Redeemer now is. He was dead. But He is alive, and He lives forevermore. Death may deprive us of our friends here, but it cannot deprive us of this our best friend. We have this best of friends, this mighty Redeemer, to go to, in all our afflictions. And He is not one who cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities. He has suffered far greater sorrows than we have ever suffered. And if we are actually united to Him, the union can never be broken, but will continue when we die, and when heaven and earth are dissolved. Therefore, in this we may be confident, though the earth He removed, in Him we shall triumph with everlasting joy. Now, when storms and tempests arise, we may resort to Him, who is a hiding place from the storm, and a covert from the tempest. When we thirst, we may come to Him, who is as rivers of water in a dry place. When we are weary, we may go to Him, who is as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. Having found Him, who is as the apple tree among the trees of the wood, we may sit under His shadow with great delight, and His fruit will be sweet to our taste. Christ said to His disciples, "In the world ye shall have tribulation, but in Me ye shall have peace." If we are united to Him, we shall be like a tree planted by the waters, and that spreadeth out its roots by the river, that shall not see when He cometh, but its leaf shall ever be green, and it shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall it cease from yielding fruit. He will now be our light in darkness, our morning star, shining as the sure harbinger of approaching day. In a little time, He will arise on our souls, as the sun in His glory. And our sun shall no more go down, and there shall be no interposing cloud, no veil on His face, or on our hearts. But the Lord shall be our everlasting light, and our Redeemer our glory. That this glorious Redeemer would manifest His glory and love to your mind, and apply what little I have said on this subject to your consolation, in all your afflictions, and abundantly reward your kindness and generosity to me while I was at Kittery, is the fervent prayer, madam, of your ladyship's most obliged and affectionate friend and most humble servant, Jonathan Edwards. The repeated afflictions of a widowed sister, in the beginning of the next year, occasioned the following letter to his father, containing some allusions to the state and circumstances of his own family. To the Reverend Timothy Edwards, East Windsor, Stockbridge, January 27, 1752. Honored Sir, We have lately heard the sorrowful tidings of the death of two of Sister Bacchus's 43 children, as we are informed, both at your house. Which is the occasion of Cousin Eunice returning from Stockbridge at this time. She having a desire to see her mother and surviving sisters at Windsor, on this melancholy occasion. We are much affected with sister's great and heavy afflictions, and lament the death of two such likely, promising children, in their early youth. It is my earnest desire, that it may be sanctified to us of this family. I desire your prayers, that it may be so. Particularly to those that are young in the family. That they may be awakened by it to diligent preparation for death. And that we all may take notice of our distinguished mercies, with a becoming thankfulness to God. I look upon it as a great favor of heaven, that you, my parents, are still preserved in the land of the living, to so great an age. I hope, by the leave of divine providence, to make you and Sister Bacchus a visit in the spring. We are, through mercy, in our ordinary state of health, except that little Betty don't seem of late to be so well as she was in the summer. If she lives till spring, I believe we must be obliged to come again to the use of a cold bath with her. My wife and children are well pleased with our present situation. They like the place far better than they expected. Here, at present, we live in peace. Which has of long time been an unusual thing with us. The Indians seem much pleased with my family, especially my wife. They are generally more sober and serious than they used to be. Beside the Stockbridge Indians, here are above 60 of the Six Nations, who live here for the sake of instruction. 20 are lately come to dwell here, who came from about 200 miles beyond Albany. We expect our son and daughter parsons will remove hither in a short time. Many of their goods are already brought up. After alluding to the indigent circumstances of his sister Mrs. Bacchus and her family, and mentioning that himself and Mrs. Edwards had done everything for his niece which was in their power, he proceeds. I hope some of her friends will be kind to her in this respect. There are perhaps none of her uncles but are much better able to help her than I am at this time. Who, by reason of lately marrying two children, and the charge of buying, building, and removing, am, I suppose, about 2,000 inches debt, in this province money 44. I should be glad if Sister Mary would suggest it to Brother Ellsworth to do something for her. If she don't care to do it in her own name, let her do it in mine, as doing the errand for me. Please to give my duty to my mother, and my love to Sister Mary. My wife is at this moment from home. My children give their duty to their grandparents, and aunts, and love and affectionate condolence to their mournful surviving cousins. I am, honored sir, your dutiful son, Jonathan Edwards. The allusion to his pecuniary circumstances, made by Mr. Edwards in the preceding letter, requires explanation. What was the actual amount of his salary at Northampton, I have not been able to ascertain. But he speaks of it, in one of his letters, as the largest salary of any country minister in New England. Soon after his settlement there, he purchased a valuable homestead, with the requisite lands for pasturage and fuel, and erected a commodious dwelling house. These, by the strictest economy, had all been paid for before his dismission. It was several years. However, after his removal to Stockbridge, before he could sell his property at Northampton. In the meantime, he was under the necessity of purchasing another homestead, and of erecting another dwelling house at Stockbridge. The debt thus incurred, added to the expense of removing his family, subjected them for a time to very serious pecuniary embarrassments. And his daughters, who had received not only an enlightened, but a polished education, readily lent their aid, to relieve the family from the existing pressure. For this purpose, they occupied their leisure in making lace and embroidering, in tambouring and other ornamental work, and in making and painting fans. All of which, in the existing state of the country, found a ready market at Boston 45 at length. The sale of his property in Northampton relieved him from debt, and placed his family in more pleasant circumstances. On the 5th of February, O.S. Mr. Gideon Hawley, a young gentleman of a liberal education, and of great prudence, firmness, and integrity, arrived at Stockbridge. He had been appointed, by the commissioners, the schoolmaster of the Mohawk and other Iroquois children, and entered immediately on the duties of his office. He was ordained as a minister and missionary, July 31, 1734, and as Mr. Edwards found him a most faithful and useful coadjutor. He also occasionally preached to the Iroquois, as did Mr. Edwards once every Sabbath. Soon after the removal of Mr. Edwards to Stockbridge, in consequence of the misunderstandings and jealousies subsisting between some of the principal English inhabitants of the town, and the confusion in which he saw the Indian affairs involved, he was led, in a letter to the Honorable Mr. Hubbard, of August 31, 1751, to recommend the appointment of two or more trustees, men perfectly impartial, no way interested in, related to, or engaged with, the contending parties. The absolute necessity of this step to the welfare of the mission, and of the Indian schools, soon became apparent. 46. In consequence of the increasing importance of the Indian establishment at Stockbridge, and the increasing attention of the public to the mission and the schools, the benefactions of the legislature and of individuals were increasing, and still likely to increase by the augmented numbers of the House St. Knox, and the accession of a Mohawk colony. It had become the principal mission of the Society for Propagating the Gospel in New England, and appeared destined to receive the chief amount of its revenue. Mr. Hollis had increased his annual stipend to 160 STG. Mr. Payne was proposing to support a female boarding school. The legislature of the province had just voted 500 provincial currency for the schoolhouse, and would probably aid in the support of the mistress. An adequate support was now given to the instructor of the House St. Knox School. An annual stipend was given to the House St. Knox, to be expended at Stockbridge for their benefit. A similar stipend was to be paid for the Mohawks, if they removed in considerable numbers to Stockbridge. A school, to be supported by the colony, for the education of their children, was not only pledged, but actually begun. And hopes were indulged that the yearly stipend of 500 STG granted by the king to the Mohawks might be expended under the direction of an agent residing at Stockbridge, and not as before at Albany. It needed no great discernment to discover that the amount of these numerous items must be great, and the bare possibility of engrossing the agency through which this large aggregate must pass, and of turning it into a source of great private emolument, might easily excite the strong cupidity of individuals, and lead them to resort to every measure in their power to secure that emolument to themselves. The opponent of Mr. Woodbridge, whose influence in the town, and with the Indians, had been long chiefly extinct, in consequence of the strong recommendation given of him by his nephew, while in London, to the directors of the Society for Propagating the Gospel in New England, had been appointed one of the board of commissioners of that society. As had the nephew himself, another of the same board. One of his family, through the same recommendation, had been conditionally nominated as the teacher of the female school. 47. One of the trustees of the Indian establishment was about to connect himself with the family. And, if the nomination should be confirmed, it was his intention to remove to Stockbridge, in order to take a superintendence of Indian affairs, which, in the absence of his colleagues, would be sole and exclusive. So fair was the prospect at this time, in the view of these individuals, of engrossing the profit and the direction of the whole establishment in their own hands, that they threw off their wonted caution, and made known their purpose of removing every obstacle in the way of their designs. Mr. Edwards well knew that the influence of these individuals was most formidable, two of them being now members of the Board of Commissioners, on which, as Indian missionary, he was dependent, one of them being one of the trustees for the Indians at Stockbridge, one of them being personally acquainted with the directors in London, and two of them having considerable influence with the principal men in the provincial government. Yet he saw, just as dearly, that, if their plans succeeded, the funds appropriated to the literary and moral improvement of the Indians would be perverted to the purpose of individual aggrandizement. In such a state of things, he was not at a loss as to his own duty. The question, whether the individual nominated by the board of directors in London, as the teacher of the female school, should be appointed, having been thus submitted, for final decision, to the board of commissioners in Boston. Their secretary wrote to Mr. Edwards, for an explicit statement of the facts relating to, the subject. Thus called upon, he did not hesitate to present the whole case, in a reply to the secretary, bearing date February 18, 1752. In this letter, after stating it to be absolutely necessary that his correspondent should be let into some of the secrets of the affairs of Stockbridge, and after alluding to his having, on account of the controversy there subsisting, recommended, formerly, the appointment of two or more impartial trustees, no way interested in, or related to, the contending parties, to inspect those affairs. He states, among other things, the following particulars: when he recommended the appointment of these trustees, he little suspected that one of them would prove the furthest of any person whatever from possessing the indispensable qualification of impartiality, in consequence of his being about to become the son-in-law of one of the contending parties. The preceding year, a very formal pacification took place between Mr. Woodbridge and his opponent, with solemn promises made by the latter that he would thenceforward live peacefully with Mr. W., and no more speak ill of him, nor in any wise molest him. But the proposed alliance, the nomination of one of his family as teacher of the female school, and the appointment of himself and his nephew to the Board of Commissioners, had so elated him that those promises appeared to be wholly forgotten. A sudden and strange alteration had also appeared in the temper and conduct of his intended son-in-law, who, in the absence of his colleagues, claimed the sole management of all Indian affairs, so that nothing was done but he was the doer of it. The Indians had a most unfavorable opinion of the opponent of Mr. Woodbridge, and the deepest prejudice against him, in consequence of his having often molested them with respect to their lands and other affairs, and, as they thought, having done very unjustly by them. This prejudice was extended to the family, and that to such a degree that, after offering to feed and clothe such of their children as should be sent to the school, attempted to be established, only four could be procured, 3 Housatonecs and 1 Mohawk. And the parents of these four complained loudly of the treatment of their children. Whether this prejudice was well or ill-founded, it was too deep to be eradicated. Very improper use had been made of the money given by Mr. Hollis. He had made large remittances, and to no good purpose, and was kept in entire ignorance as to the actual state of things at Stockbridge. The individual who received his money, and boarded, and professed to instruct the children, had never established a regular school, and had never kept any regular accounts of his expenditures. No government was maintained, little attention paid to the manners of the children, and all was suffered to go on in wildness, filth, and confusion, to the great offense of such as visited the place. The generous design of Mr. Hollis had been totally defeated, and the large sum of money he had given had been wholly lost, and worse than lost. The same boys, without this additional expense, would have been far better instructed and governed at the school of Mr. Woodbridge. There, they would have been taught reading, cleanliness, good manners and good morals, all of which had been wholly neglected on the part of their professed instructor, who had himself been absent from Stockbridge for a long period. This irregularity and disorderly management led the Mohawks to take all their children away from him after the arrival of Mr. Hawley, and to place them under the care of the latter. Yet the former, wishing some pretext for drawing the money of Mr. Hollis, and not being able to procure any of the Indian boys to form a school, went regularly into the school kept by Mr. Hawley, and proceeded to treat the boys as if they were under his own care, alleging that he was the superintendent of a male school. No one had been more open and abundant in speaking of his uselessness, his exceeding unfitness for the business of an instructor, and the disorder and filthiness in which things were kept under his care, or in declaring that it was high time that he was dismissed from the employment, than the resident trustee. But, in consequence of his new connection, he had suddenly changed his mind, and now declared that he must be retained. A similar change had taken place in his treatment of Mr. Edwards. For many years he had constantly professed the highest respect for him, far beyond what the latter could, with any modesty, expect. He had often expressed a higher esteem of him than of any minister in New England, as well as a very strong desire of living under his ministry. Yet, although Mr. Edwards had never had a word of difference with him, or his new connections, his whole conduct was suddenly and entirely changed, and he had sided with them in all their measures of opposition and violence. Very singular management had been used with respect to Mr. Hawley. Before his arrival, Dark representations were carried to him, misrepresentations of the actual state of things at Stockbridge, to discourage him from accepting his appointment. Soon after his arrival, it was openly given out that he would soon be removed. Had it not been for his firmness, prudence, and steadiness of temper, he would have been laid under great and permanent disadvantages. The resident trustee had warned him not to depend on M.R. Edwards, and challenged to himself the whole authority of directing the school and the affairs of the Indians. When the society in London recommended the proposed teacher of the female school, they could not have been aware that her nearest kinsmen were to be the committee to examine her accounts. But the actual state of things was soon to be still more preposterous. She being the mistress, her nearest relatives were to be her counsel, and her husband the sole committee to examine her accounts and make report to the legislature. Mr. Edwards then adds, "I write these things, honored sir, because I am satisfied you have not heretofore been enlightened in the true state of things, as you ought to have been. It was my knowledge of some of these matters, though but little in comparison, which occasioned me, when last in Boston, so earnestly to press the commissioners frequently to visit this place. I have been slow to speak. My disposition has been entirely to suppress what I knew that would be to the disadvantage of any of the people here. But I dare not hold my peace any longer. You doubtless will own, sir, that it is but doing you justice, for somebody or other to let you know the true state of things, in a matter of such vast importance, which is under your care, and which you being at so great a distance never can know, but by the information of some that live here. And I know of no one from whom you can more reasonably expect it, than from the missionary you have sent here, to have the special care of the interests of religion among the Indians. I did not intend to interfere with the affair of the teacher of the female school, or to say anything that should tend to hinder it, and therefore avoided everything of that nature in my letter to Sir William Pepperell. But being now questioned again by the honorable commissioners, and the tendency of the measure more and more appearing, I thought that this was the time when God called on me to speak, and that if I should hold my peace now, I should perhaps lay a foundation for great uneasiness to my conscience all my life after, when I might deeply lament the continued consequences of my silence, and when it would be too late to speak. The next day Mr. Edwards addressed a letter to the commissioners in Boston, in which, after announcing the arrival of Mr. Hawley, and the high gratification of the Mohawks at the establishment of a regular school for their boys, he states the number of his scholars to be at that time 36, mentions his happy qualifications as an instructor, and in compliance with their request gives, very summarily, his own views respecting a proper teacher for the female boarding school. During the spring of 1752, the state of affairs in Stockbridge, instead of improving, only grew worse. The interference of the former schoolmaster with the school of Mr. Hawley produced so much confusion that, in the latter part of April, one half of the Mohawks left Stockbridge in utter disgust with him and his friends, and fully resolved never to return. A few days after their departure, an intimate friend of the former schoolmaster and his associates, visiting the male Mohawk school, under the care of M.R. Hawley, struck a child of the chief sachem at the Onokwagas on the head with his cane, without any manner of provocation. The mother of this child was a woman of remarkable piety. This unhappy occurrence excited the universal indignation of the remaining Iroquois, and they appeared resolved, all of them, to pack up their effects immediately and be gone. Mr. Hawley and the interpreter, finding it impossible to calm them, came to Mr. Edwards for advice, but he, having been often blamed for interfering with the affairs of the Iroquois, and told that, in doing so, he meddled with it which was none of his business, referred them to the resident trustee, advising them to represent the whole affair to him, that he might use proper means to prevent the fatal consequences which were feared. Their doing so was, however, regarded as the result of a disposition to find fault with him and his friends. The chiefs of the Onokwagas, finding no redress, went to Mr. Edwards to make their complaint for this violent assault. There they found the aggressor, who, in order to pacify them, was persuaded to pay them a sum of money. The resident trustee, angry at what had occurred, went to the boarding school and proceeded to abuse Mr. Hawley in the presence of the whole school, in a very fervid manner, telling him that he was a man of no judgment and of no prudence, and that he was unfit for the business he was in, and continued this abuse for 3 hours together as his conversation was very loud. The Iroquois heard it, and came to the spot, expressing their fears for the personal safety of Mr. Hawley, to whom they had become much attached. Apprehending that, in consequence of this violence, he might be induced to leave Stockbridge, they declared, in a body, that, if he went away, they would go also. By these occurrences, the Indian were as effectually alienated from the resident trustee, as they had previously been from his new friends. In consequence of these unhappy measures, and of a settled determination, on his part, to take, in the absence of his colleagues, the whole management of Indian affairs on himself, they also were disgusted. One of them relinquished all connection with the business, and ceased to visit Stockbridge altogether. The other openly announced his entire discouragement, and declared that he would do his utmost to induce the government to withdraw their support from the establishment of the Iroquois. This led to an attempt to procure the dismission of the latter, and the appointment of a connection of the resident trustee, which however proved unsuccessful. At the same time, it was publicly and repeatedly announced that Mr. Edwards himself would be removed from his mission. And, as soon after it appeared, a vigorous attempt was actually made to accomplish this object. 48. Having stated these facts in a letter to the Secretary of the Commissioners, of May, 1752, Mr. Edwards proceeds, "But still I think there is no necessity of the Iroquois establishment being broken up, unless its enemies are resolved to have it so. The dependence of the establishment, as to continuance and prosperity, is chiefly on the Onokwagas, who are much the best disposed of any of the Iroquois, and most likely to come in considerable numbers. They have not been here so long as the others, to see so much to discourage them, and they alone are willing to settle at the Hoplands. The affair is not at all desperate as to them, nor as to some of the Mohawks, if there be a speedy alteration. But if the two individuals, who challenge to themselves the whole direction of the affairs of the Iroquois, continue here, there is no hope of the continuance of Mr. Hawley, or of Mr. Ashley and his wife. They will not continue under one whom they regard as so despotic an inspector. And there will be no way to retain any of the Indians, unless it be some who are entirely mercenary, who may be persuaded to stay for the sake of the presents that are made them, and to be maintained and live here in mere idleness. This, it is now very apparent, is all that moves many of the Canangees, in being and continuing here. The resident trustee 49 has plainly discovered many designs, tending to bring money into his own pocket, namely, a design of taking care of M.R. Hollis's boys himself. A design of being steward of both boarding schools, by which he will have the opportunity of supplying the Indians out of his own shop, and of getting his pay from the British funds. A design of introducing his son, as the master of the boarding school, under the idea of a present supply, another proper person not appearing. And an expectation of diverting the king's bounty, of 500 sterling, to the Six Nations, from New York. The former schoolmaster has given hints of an agreement, between himself and him, to resign the care of Mr. Hollis's scholars to him, when things are ripe for it, he providing for their maintenance, and taking care of their instruction by his son. Beside these things, his wife is to be mistress of the female school, and two of their sons to be maintained and educated at the public expense, and two of their girls, in like manner, to be maintained in the female school, and one of his family to be his wife's usher, and his servants to be paid for, under the character of servants employed in the affairs of the female school, and the house for the boarding school set on his wife's land, and then the farm to be bought by the country for the school, with the advantage of selling it at a high rate, and yet the family in a great measure to be maintained on the produce of it, beside the advantage of carrying on a trade, both with the Stockbridge Indians and the Mohawks. A man had need to have a great stock of assuredness, to urge a public affair, under so manifold temptations of private interest. The time of Mr. Edwards had been so much occupied by his removal from Northampton, the comfortable establishment of his family at Stockbridge, the ordinary duties of his parish and his mission, the claims of the Mohawks, the concerns of the various Indian schools, and the unhappy contentions of the whites, that he had, at first, no leisure to attend to the reply of M.R. Williams. In the latter part of the spring, however, he began an answer to that gentleman, which he sent to the press the beginning of July 50, with the following title: Misrepresentations Corrected and Truth Vindicated, in a reply to the Reverend Mr. Solomon Williams's book, entitled, The True State of the Question, Concerning the Qualifications Necessary to Lawful Communion in the Christian Sacraments. It was read with deep interest by both parties, was admitted by both to be a triumphant answer to the true state of the question, and, taken in connection with the humble attempt, was regarded by the friends of strict communion, at that time, as it has ever since been, as an unanswerable defense of their system. If the opposers of that system have not so regarded it, they have not publicly avowed the opposite opinion, as no attempt to answer it has hitherto appeared. Mr. Williams is said to have asked the advice of some of his friends, among the clergy, whether he had better commence a reply. But, finding that no one would encourage him to an attempt, which must end in reiterated defeat, he is reported to have sat down in mortified silence. Appended to this publication was a letter from Mr. Edwards to his late flock at Northampton. They had published Mr. Williams's pamphlet at their own expense, and distributed it to every family in the town. That pamphlet, though so unsuccessful an attempt to answer Mr. Edwards, was yet filled with many lax and sceptical notions, derived from the writings of Dr. Taylor of Norwich, and apparently adopted by Mr. Williams, in the existing emergency, though in direct opposition, not only to Mr. Stoddard, whom he professed at once to venerate and defend, but to his own former publications. Though M.R. Edwards knew that the work of Mr. W. must soon go to its proper place, yet he also knew the state of fervid excitement in which his former congregation had long been. That they had printed and dispersed the pamphlet of Mr. W., even without knowing its contents, as an answer to his own treatise, and thus, in a sense, had adopted it before the world as their own work. These circumstances led him to fear that the fatal errors abounding in the work of Mr. Williams might, at a period when the principles of Dr. Taylor of Norwich were gaining many converts in the colonies, mislead many, especially of the young, among his former people. To save them from this danger, he addressed to them an affectionate and truly pastoral letter, which will be found at the close of the answer to Mr. Williams 51. On the 29th of June, 1752, Mr. Edwards married his third daughter, Esther, to the Rev. Aaron Burr, of Newark, president of the College of New Jersey, then established in that town, and a few years afterwards removed to Princeton. In the following letter to Mr. Erskine, which is rich in intelligence, as well as thought, the reader will find one fact not generally known, that M.R. Edwards, in the latter part of the summer of 1751, was applied to, with much earnestness, by some parish in Virginia, to go and settle with them in the ministry. They offered him a handsome support, and sent a messenger with the offer, but his installment at Stockbridge had taken place before his arrival. To the Revelation John Erskine. Stockbridge, July 7, 1752. Rev. and dear brother. The last spring I received a letter from you, dated, at the beginning, July 17, and at the end, September 5, 1751, and the week before last I received another letter, dated February 11, 1752, with a packet, containing Arnold de la Effarquent Communion, Goodwin's sermon at the ordination of Mr. Pickering. Mr. Jarvis's sermon on methods for reviving religion. Reasons of dissent from the sentence of the General Assembly. Edwards on Christ, God-Man. M.R. Hartley's sermon, Parish on the Assembly's Catechism. And Dr. Gill's sermon on Isaiah 11:12. I heartily thank you for these letters and pamphlets. Arnold on frequent communion will not be very profitable to me, by reason of my not understanding the French. But several of the rest have been very agreeable to me. That letter which you mention in your last, dated February 11th, is sent about a 12-month before, containing some remarks on the decay of the power of the papal clergy, and an abstract of Venema's reasonings to prove that Judas was not present at the Lord's Supper, I never received, and regretted much that I missed it, and request that you would still send me those remarks on the decay of the papal clergy. I am obliged to you for the particular information you have given me, concerning Mr. Adam of Falkirk's affair. Though it is a pity so deserving a person should suffer at all from his brethren, only for not acting contrary to his conscience. Yet it is a matter of thankfulness, that the assembly of the year 51 showed so much better temper than that of the preceding year. I shall be glad to hear concerning the temper and conduct of the assembly of this present year, 1752. I am sorry to learn that there is so much reason to fear that the revival of religion in the Netherlands will be hindered and brought under a cloud through the prevailing of imprudences. It is what I was afraid I should hear. I should be glad to see the pastoral letter you mention against fanaticism, though written by one disaffected to the revival. I wish I could see a history of enthusiasm through all ages written by some good hand, a hearty friend of vital religion, a person of accurate judgment, and large acquaintance with ecclesiastical history. Such a history, well written, might doubtless be exceedingly useful and instructive, and of great benefit to the Church of God. Especially, if there were united with it a proper account and history of true religion. I should therefore choose that the work should be a history of true, vital, and experimental religion, an enthusiasm bringing down the history from age to age, judiciously and clearly making the distinction between one and the other, observing the difference of source, progress, and issue, properly pointing out the limits, and doing justice to each, in every age, and at each remarkable period. I don't know that there is any such thing extant, or anything that would, in any good measure, answer the same purpose. If there be, I should be glad to hear of it. I thank you for the account you give me of Mr. Taylor's writings, and of the things which he is doing to propagate his opinions. It now appears to be a remarkable time in the Christian world. Perhaps such an one, as never has been before, things are going downhill so fast, and truth and religion, both of heart and practice, are departing by such swift steps, that I think it must needs be that a crisis is not very far off, and what will then appear, I will not pretend to determine. The last week I sent away my answer to Mr. Williams. If I live till it is published, I will endeavor to send one to you, and some other friends in Scotland. I hope now, in a short time, to be at leisure to resume my design of writing something on the Armenian controversy. I have no thought of going through with all parts of the controversy at once, but the subject which I intended, God willing, first to write something upon, was free will and moral agency. Endeavoring, with as much exactness as I am able, to consider the nature of that freedom of moral agents, which makes them the proper subjects of moral government, moral precepts, counsels, calls, motives, persuasions, promises and threatenings, praise and blame, rewards and punishments, strictly examining the modern notions of these things, endeavoring to demonstrate their most palpable inconsistency and absurdity. Endeavoring also to bring the late great objections and outcries against Calvinistic divinity, from these topics, to the test of the strictest reasoning. And particularly that great objection, in which the modern writers have so much gloried, so long triumphed, with so great a degree of insult towards the most excellent divines, and in effect against the gospel of Jesus Christ, namely, that the Calvinistic notions of God's moral government are contrary to the common sense of mankind. In this essay, I propose to take particular notice of the writings of Dr. Whitby, and Mr. Chubb, and the writings of some others, who, though not properly Pelagians, nor Armenians, yet in their notions of the freedom of the will, have, in the main, gone into the same scheme. But, if I live to prosecute my design, I shall send you a more particular account of my plan after it is perfected. I suppose there has been a trial before now, whether a national collection can be obtained in Scotland, for New Jersey College, unless it has been thought prudent, by such as are friends of the affair, to put it off a year longer. As some things I have seen seem to argue. There was a design of M.R. Pemberton's going to England and Scotland. He was desired by the trustees, and it was his settled purpose, to have gone the last year. But his people, and his colleague, Mr. Cummings, hindered it. His intention of going occasioned great uneasiness among his people, and created some dissatisfaction towards him, in the minds of some of them. Since that, President Burr has been desired to go, by the unanimous voice of the trustees. Nevertheless, I believe there is little probability of his consenting to it. Partly, on the account of his having lately entered into a married state. On the 29th of last month, he was married to my third daughter. What you write of the appointment of a gentleman, to the office of Lieutenant Governor, of Virginia, who is a friend of religion, is an event that the Friends of Religion in America have great reason to rejoice in, by reason of the late revival of religion in their province, and the opposition that has been made against it, and the great endeavors to crush it, by many of the chief men of the province. Mr. Davies, in a letter I lately received from him, dated March 2, 1752, mentions the same thing. His words are, "We have a new governor, who is a candid, condescending gentleman. And, as he has been educated in the Church of Scotland, he has a respect for the Presbyterians, which I hope is a happy omen. I was in the latter part of the last summer applied to, with much earnestness and importunity, by some of the people of Virginia, to come and settle among them, in the work of the ministry, who subscribed handsomely for my encouragement and support, and sent a messenger to me with their request and subscriptions. But I was installed at Stockbridge before the messenger came. I have written some account of the state of things at Stockbridge to M.R. Lurin, which you doubtless will have opportunity to see. July 24th. The people of Northampton are still destitute of a minister, and in broken sorrow for circumstances. They had the last winter Mr. Ferrand, a young gentleman from New Jersey College, but contended much about him, so that he has left them. They are now in a state of contention. My warmest opposers are quarrelling among themselves. I hear they have lately sent for a young preacher, a Mr. Green of Barnstable, who is soon expected. But I know nothing of his character. Another minister has lately been dismissed from his people, on the same account that I was dismissed from Northampton, namely, Mr. Billings of Cold Spring. Many of the Cold Spring people were originally of Northampton, were educated in the principles, and have followed the example of the people there. I heartily thank you for the accounts you have from time to time sent me of new books that are published in Great Britain. I desire you would continue such a favor. I am fond of knowing how things are going on in the literary world. Mr. John Wright, a member of New Jersey College, who is to take the degree of Bachelor of Arts the next September, is now at my house. He was born in Scotland, has lived in Virginia, is a friend and acquaintance of Mr. Davies, has a great interest in the esteem of the religious people of Virginia, and is peculiarly esteemed by President Burr, has been admitted to special intimacy with him, and is a person of very good character for his understanding, prudence, and piety. He has a desire to have a correspondence with some divine of his native country, and has chosen you for his correspondent, if he may be admitted to such a favor. He intends to send you a letter with this, of which I would ask a favorable reception, as he has laid me under some special obligations. My wife joins with me in affectionate salutations to you, and Mrs. Erskine. Hoping that we shall continue to remember each other at the throne of grace, I am, dear sir, your affectionate and obliged brother and servant, Jonathan Edwards. Soon after he had entered on the mission at Stockbridge, Mr. Edwards addressed the Revelation Mr. Hollis, by letter, concerning the Indian schools and the state of the mission at large. The observations of a year had now brought him far more intimately acquainted with the actual state of things, and particularly, with the manner in which the annual benefactions of that gentleman had been expended. And he felt himself bound, at whatever hazard, to make the facts known. In doing this, he presented him, in a letter bearing date July 17, 1752, with a succinct and well-drawn history of the mission, and stated, in general terms, the unhappy disagreement subsisting among the English inhabitants of Stockbridge, as well as various other circumstances of malignant aspect, which threatened ruin to the mission and to the Indian schools. Want of room forbids its insertion. With this letter, he forwarded to Mr. Hollis a certificate from a large number of the most respectable people of the town, stating the actual conduct of his agent, or instructor, the condition of the Indian boys, and the manner in which his benefactions had been perverted. The firm and undeviating course of conduct pursued by Mr. Edwards, with regard to the Indian schools, and the general concerns of the mission, at length convinced the resident trustee, and his new friends, that they had nothing to hope from any compliances on his part. They resolved, therefore, if possible, to effect his removal from Stockbridge. With this view, that gentleman repaired to Boston, and endeavored, in conversation, not only with the commissioners, but with some of the principal men in the government, and among others, with the secretary of the province, to produce in their minds very unfavorable impressions concerning him, particularly, that he was a man of an unyielding character, and unwilling to be reconciled to those from whom he had differed. And that, by this course, he was likely to ruin the Indian mission. The friends of Mr. Edwards, in Boston, giving him timely notice of this attempt, he addressed a letter to the Honorable Mr. Willard, in his own defense, bearing date July 17, 1752, in which he so effectually refuted these representations that the influence of that gentleman was permanently secured in favor of the mission and its real friends.